Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. The Affordable Care Act is celebrating its 10th anniversary. The landmark legislation has had a huge impact on the way healthcare operates in the United States. More than 20 million people have health insurance as a result of the ACA, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Still, since it passed in 2010, the ACA has faced challenges that threaten its efficacy. Today, as the country grapples with a pandemic, there are questions about the kind of care this legislation guarantees and its limitations. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. He recently wrote a paper examining the ACA for the journal Health Affairs. Rocco is here in the studio. Phil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Hey, great to be here, Joy.
Before the ACA, what was insurance like in the United States?
Yeah, so before the Affordable Care Act, the number of people with health insurance had been slowly declining, really, since the 1970s. And one of the reasons this is that employers were facing higher and higher costs for medical care, right, as medical inflation went up. And at the same time, the number of people who were protected by labor unions was decreasing. And so gradually insurers like lost the incentive that they had to maintain that coverage. ERISA was a law which allowed some insurers to self-insure. So they pulled out of larger group plans, created their own plans. And so you started to see greater instability in these larger risk pools. And so over time, fewer and fewer people had insurance from their employers, which is really sort of was supposed to be the backbone for working age Americans, the way that the federal government sort of subsidized health insurance for employers beginning in the 1940s. It was really supposed to be the backbone, but by the 1990s, that had really began to crater. And so what many Americans without insurance, my grandparents, for example, who had a small business, had to buy plans on the very, very limited individual marketplace, because most people didn't buy the plans until they were sick. Premiums were sky high. These plans also had a number of restrictions on coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, including kids with like chickenpox, for example. In some cases, there are all kinds of horror stories you can go back and look at. And of course, Medicaid, which is now we think of as a program that covers about 1 in 5 Americans. Many low-income Americans receive health insurance through Medicaid. It was a plan that was much more restricted to select sort of populations, people with disabilities, low-income seniors who had needed help with two or more activities, daily living, things like that. The system was even more fragmented than it is presently.
So how did the Affordable Care Act respond, essentially, to a lot of these exclusions, a lot of the issues that we had with these health insurance plans before this piece of legislation was ultimately crafted?
So one way of thinking about it is for many years prior to the Affordable Care Act, in fact, most of the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s, the emphasis on what national health insurance should look like was a reform that made the system universal. Medicare for All, effectively, was on presidential platforms for Jimmy Carter. Even Richard Nixon supported this. But there's a real change in the political economy of health insurance, especially in the 1990s. Insurers became a really powerful lobby against this sort of comprehensive reform. Pharmaceuticals, as well, had become a really sort of powerful and entrenched lobby to prevent that kind of systemic reform. And so in 2010, the strategy of the Obama administration and Democratic leaders in Congress was that rather than try to get through that gauntlet of interest group politics to actually bring in what had been historical opponents of comprehensive reform and actually make them into some of the authors of the legislation. So key provisions of the ACA were written by America's health insurance plans, written by pharma lobbyists, written by these sort of interests. Now, in the end, not all of these sectors signed on to the legislation. So for example, the insurance industry started out as a partner, but ultimately bailed because the ACA had some provisions that restricted insurers from charging people more based on their age, the so-called community rating provisions. But the general strategy of the ACA was rather than remaking the system, to try to fill in the gaps in coverage that people experience. So on the one hand, taking this individual marketplace, which had been incredibly limited and prohibitively costly, and providing subsidies to insurers and people who didn't qualify for Medicaid so that they could purchase insurance on the individual marketplace. On the other hand, take Medicaid and expand coverage to all individuals with incomes of up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is in individual person terms about $17,000 per person today. And then to take some other steps to restructure the rules around what insurers had to cover, covering people with pre-existing conditions, adult children being able to be on their parents' insurance till the age of 26, a variety of sort of individual market reforms, and then thousands of pages of other provisions designed to, you know, sort of reform the way that care is delivered and paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So in a way, it was an approach to reform that wasn't about systemic transformation, but about sort of plugging in some of the gaps in coverage.
What are some of the most notable gaps that have been filled as a result of the ACA?
So one way of thinking about this is that the ACA accounts for about 20 million more Americans receiving coverage. And some of those key gaps that have been filled, I think, are really at the lower end of the income distribution, people who qualify for Medicaid because they live at 138% of the federal poverty level or less. Of course, because of the Supreme Court's 2012 ruling in a case called NFIB versus Sebelius, states didn't have to expand Medicaid. States could opt in. So a lot of states chose not to opt in to Medicaid expansion, and about 14 states still have not opted in at one level or another. And so in many ways, that gap is filled, but it depends on where you live. The individual marketplace was supposed to be a sort of crucial gap-filling measure for people living above 138% of the federal poverty level, but still lower middle-income folks. But those plans remain quite expensive depending on where you are. Insurers have had varying incentives to come in and stick around in the marketplace. And the premiums in those plans, as well as the cost sharing in those plans, can remain prohibitively costly for a lot of people. And so the ACA, you can think about it as vastly reducing the number of people without any coverage at all, but there are a number of people who remain underinsured, meaning they're spending a significant portion of their annual income on the care that they need, either through premiums or cost sharing.
You know, you mentioned 14 states have not expanded Medicaid. I believe we're in one of those states.
Yeah, that's right. Wisconsin has not expanded Medicaid. There was a move during the Walker administration to change Wisconsin's Medicaid waiver to expand coverage up to 100% of the federal poverty level within Badger Care. So it was sort of a punt, an attempt to do something else. But no, we haven't expanded Medicaid in Wisconsin.
For states that have expanded Medicaid, what has that ultimately meant for their coverage?
I mean, coverage has expanded pretty dramatically in states that expanded Medicaid. And I think this has impacts not just for individuals. Certainly does. Health outcomes have changed significantly. There's been a measurable decrease in mortality rates among a variety of populations within Medicaid and states that have expanded it. But also, it has had a huge effect on hospitals. So the amount of care that is uncompensated in hospitals has been drastically reduced in states that expanded Medicaid.
So it's ultimately been helpful for hospital systems.
You can think about it as something that has helped to sustain and even solidify the infrastructural capacity of hospitals, especially in rural areas.
I was about to say, that seems significant because we know there are a lot of rural hospitals that are having a lot of financial difficulties.
Yeah, and I think this is something that remains an issue for rural hospital systems. The limited population, the fact that it can be difficult to staff key departments in the hospital, these all contribute to real infrastructural challenges, even if it's something that's not causing the hospital to have real organizational or fiscal problems today. It's something that people are worried about. And so that is something that I think you can see the Medicaid expansion is having one sort of primary impact, not just on individuals' ability to get insurance, but like what we think of as the health infrastructure that we live in. And that infrastructure matters not only for the people who have Medicaid or Medicare or coverage financed through some part of the ACA, but people who just need to go to the hospital, right, if there's some kind of emergency.
So going back to some of the provisions inside of the ACA, you know, there are certain ones that I certainly didn't know about before they came into play in my life. We were just talking about this before the interview. I had to get a number of vaccinations recently, and I found out they were $0 because they were suggested by the CDC. What are some of these lesser-known provisions that have come out of the ACA that have a big impact?
Yeah, I think the essential health benefits is one of the big ones. It is, you know, the sort of protections for treatments, preventative treatments that are recommended by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, things like vaccine, right? Those are really important, but there's something that you don't recognize until you need it. $11 billion for community health centers, which in a city like Milwaukee provide a crucial, absolutely essential part of our health infrastructure here. Also, just the idea that primary care is something that there should be an essential health benefit, something that getting a preventative screening, a checkup, you know, your annual wellness visit, that should be something that you don't have to pay a significant amount of money for cost sharing or out-of-pocket expenses for. All of these sort of hidden benefits are something that make the ACA, you know, potentially like surprisingly good, but they're also something that I think creates a political risk for the law. If you think about Social Security, when it passed, people got a Social Security card, right? They knew quite simply that they would be eligible for a public pension at a certain point in time when they retired. Same thing with Medicare, right? When you reach a certain age, you just become eligible. These benefits are all fairly legible to the public. The ACA would have been difficult to describe in that way. In fact, you know, there's now this like body of experts and scholars that like make a living on translating the ACA for like a public audience. It's a patchwork of many, many different reforms. That means that in the earliest years of the law, it was very, very difficult for people to understand the ways in which it benefited them. And the law itself didn't make it easy to do. And so when you look at, for example, like public opinion on the ACA, it's divided really along partisan lines until there's a threat of repeal. And suddenly the benefits of the ACA become more visible because there's a possibility that they're going to be taken away. And patients, physicians, a number of other advocacy groups begin raising the legibility of these benefits, and suddenly they become clear. But this is sort of one lesson of policy reform, which is that if you have benefits that are great if only people knew about them, well, to what extent are you really expecting that voters are going to be able to make sense of all of these things that are wrapped in this big, complicated package? You know, are you really expecting reform to be politically sustainable if its core beneficiaries don't even know that they're beneficiaries?
Yeah. There's been a lot of confusion right now with coronavirus, with COVID-19, about what is covered by insurance, what should be covered by insurance, and what mechanisms we have inside of the ACA to deal with pandemics.
I mean, so there was an announcement by the Trump administration yesterday, I think, it said that the COVID-19 test would qualify as an essential health benefit under the ACA. But still, large employer health plans have to cover the benefit of preventative testing, but those tests don't have to be free, right? And if you think about it, one reason for this confusion and this lack of clarity is that the ACA didn't replace this very fragmented system of payers and providers that exists in the United States. That question, will you be able to get the test for free? Not a question in the United Kingdom that has a national health service, right? Not a question in Taiwan. Not a question in countries that sort of guarantee a certain minimum of health benefits as a sort of citizenship right. The fact that we still live in a pretty fragmented architecture for health coverage is one thing that contributes to this, because you have to go out looking for information. Am I going to be covered? Will this test be free? And that search for information from a sort of like consumer's perspective, although I like to think about people as patients, not consumers, it actually can inhibit people from maybe getting tested if they feel that that would be a good idea.
So this gets actually back to one of my big questions about the Affordable Care Act. What are the limitations of this piece of legislation?
I think the limitations of the Affordable Care Act are ironically related to what made it a political strength in, you know, 2010, which is it was designed to be a piece of legislation that would move through the institutional gauntlet of interest group politics, right? And the idea is don't rock the boat, fill in the gaps, deal with some of the worst exigencies created by the American healthcare system, and you will have a piece of legislation that will be a signature, landmark, historic piece of legislation. But sometimes what is good legislative politics doesn't make good health policy, right? And I think this is as true for Democrats in many ways who are trying to get a piece of legislation through the gauntlet as it is for Republicans who are sitting in state legislatures thinking about, am I going to be primaried if I vote for Medicaid expansion? And I think some of the biggest limitations of the ACA is that it really doesn't deal with some of the forces in the economy of healthcare that make healthcare persistently unaffordable for many people. It doesn't deal with the fact that prices are a significant driver of cost, and there's really no significant price control mechanisms within the Affordable Care Act. Those things are sort of left on the table. We don't allow Medicare, for example, to negotiate for drug prices, is one commonly heard refrain about some of these limitations. Another way of seeing it is that the Affordable Care Act doesn't tackle what are some of the most significant inequalities in the way that we allocate healthcare. And the kind of care that you receive depends not just on what age you are, where you fall in the income distribution, whether or not you qualify for various means-tested forms of care, but also, in some cases, who you work for, how stable that work is, and if you are covered in the individual marketplace, do you happen to live in a place where there is robust competition that drives down premiums, or do you live in a place where the risk pool is disproportionately made up of people who need a lot of care? And I find this as a scholar very difficult because sometimes you get asked a very reasonable question, what's been the effect of the Affordable Care Act on coverage? And my answer has to be this very annoying, pointy-headed, scholarly answer, which is, well, that depends on, you know, where you live and what insurance market you're in. But that, to me, is an index of what some of the gaps and inadequacies left by the Affordable Care Act are.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rocco, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. He recently wrote a paper examining the 10-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act for the journal Health Affairs.